This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'm going to be reading excerpts from the first chapter of The Eye of the Albatross. This is the third reading, the book written by Carl Safina, published in 2002. I'm going to repeat the very last part of the last reading because it's so good, and then I'll start in with new parts of the chapter. In the siege of space-time that is jet travel, it's easy to forget just how much water separates Hawaii from the continents. The Hawaiian chain comprises the most isolated islands on Earth. No other islands are so far from any mainland. And consider this, the Hawaiian chain is so disconnected from the rest of the ocean that one-third of its reef fish species are found nowhere else on Earth. Of the hundreds of Pacific coral species, fewer than 10% have ever reached the Hawaiian Islands. No land mammal, and only one bat, ever reached the islands. So few birds reached Hawaii that most of its native land birds actually evolved on the islands, adapted descendants of those stray fragments of flying DNA that were the few birds blown so far off course. Even by Hawaiian standards, the remotest part of the Hawaiian archipelago is this string of islands and atolls called the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. They stretch more than 1,000 miles west from what you usually think of as Hawaii. They include a series of isolated dots and dabs in the wide sea. Rocks and atolls and other shards of barely emergent land you may never have heard of. Nihoa Island, Necker, French Frigate Shoals, Gardner Pinnacles, Morro Reef, Lazen Island, Lisianski Island, Pearl and Hermes Reef, Midway Atoll. The only famous member, flashpoint of the pivotal World War II sea battle, and Kure Atoll. These 10 little exiled lands range in size from Morro's Reef's single emergent rock and Gardner Pinnacles' 3 dry acres to Midway's 2.3 square miles, anchored in a deep sea, yet adrift in deep time, on Earth's floating crust. These islands have become terra firma's tiny outposts to the northwest, far from surfboards, bikinis, package tours, June honeymoons, and the rest. Though little and remote, they're crammed with seabirds, 6 million breeding seabirds of 18 species. If you count juveniles and non-breeders, the number balloons to 14 million. Having just 0.1% of Hawaii's land area, they provide breeding ground for 95% of its seabirds. This includes some 600,000 breeding pairs of Lazen albatross and 60,000 black-footed albatross pairs, virtually their entire world populations. The sheer concentration of birds makes the density of life here hugely impressive. Tern Island, where we are, is among this holy group of isles. Its parent atoll, French Frigate Shoals, is a roughly circular rock and coral platform nearly 20 miles wide, dotted with scarcely dry land. Though it is the largest of the chain's atolls, most of French Frigate is the underwater lagoon. Tern Island, though less than a mile long, is the largest island here. Most of the others are too small for a long stroll and often get washed over. But these tiny sites are the reproductive generators of wildlife inhabiting many millions of square miles of ocean, including U.S. waters, other nations' territories, and the high seas. In other words, without these safe havens, wildlife populations throughout the North Pacific would shrivel. So although the area of these dollops of land is a trivially tiny fraction of the ocean's total realm, the ecological footprint of the islands is enormous, vast as the sea itself. And now I'll start a new part of this first chapter. We're on Tern Island. We stop to look at one albatross alone on its nest, just a few paces from the porch steps. Patty is planning to include this bird among the first in her satellite tracking study. I decide to give this scientific pioneer of the air a name, Amelia. The bird I'm trying to admire is, I have to say, not the most engaging bird I've ever met. Amelia has been sitting on her single egg nearly 2 weeks during this shift, oblivious to the world. Like Dr. Seuss's Horton the elephant, an incubating albatross is faithful to its egg 100%. On their nests, and there are nests on the ground all around us, they seem detached from reality. They make no eye contact. Day upon week, they sit dazed with broodiness, mostly dozing with bill tucked under wing and eyes closed, now and then opening a lid to see whether the world has gone away. They're not interested in you. Even if they're watching with one eye, they usually don't bother taking their bill from under their feathers as you walk by. They're not interested, but I am. I'm lagging behind the others so I can look enough to begin actually seeing. The albatrosses seem to maintain a certain grace despite themselves, a beauty unselfconscious as a child's. Black-footed albatrosses appear chocolate-dipped. They're the color of double fudge brownies. They're that dark. They support their brownish black bodies upon black legs and eponymous black feet. Their faces feature ashy gray detailing at the bill's base and subtly contrasting light highlighting just below their dark eyes. They walk with their necks low and outstretched, their heads going from side to side, giving them an exaggerated, hunched Groucho Marx air, a comically sinister gangster look. The lazen albatrosses, conversely, tend to take a high-stepping, high-headed waddle with their pink legs and feet. The lazens bear a blackish cape upon a white body. The head is finely airbrushed. The basic black eyes are rimmed with white-lined lids, set into a lovely dark pastel eyeshadow mask that is black just ahead of the eye and blends to a fine powder gray dust on the cheeks. Their bill is light pumpkin orange or pinkish, grading to a light gray tip. An albatross bill is a heavily constructed weapon made of a dozen or so separate plates connected as though welded, ending with a nail-like hook. It means business, and most everyone who works with albatrosses has scars to attest. Hard, tube-shaped nostrils lie along each side of the bill, indicating the albatross's membership in a large family called the tube-nosed seabirds. The softness in albatrosses is not in their feathers, which are stiff, but in the powdered gradations of color, shade, and tone, and the bits of skin exposed to air. Albatrosses' scaly feet and legs, the most reptilian parts, are most surprising. The scales are embedded in supple skin, and the webbing between the long toes is as soft as fine buckskin or chamois. The albatross's feathers form a dense and surprisingly stiff armoring against the cold sea, the blasting wind, and the beating sun. These birds live all their lives out in open weather. They know no sense of cover. Not only do they take no shelter, but they're exposed to some of the harshest extremes of heat, cold, water, and wind the world can hurl. These are sturdy beings. And so we've come to meet the albatrosses and all the other creatures on their own terms, in their own time. This year, as usual, most albatrosses arrived in November and by December had laid their eggs. Males began arriving first, perhaps a week before females. When previously mated albatrosses reconnect, they generally skip the elaborate dancing of their youthful past. With little preliminary courtship formality, older, well-acquainted mates copulate within as little as an hour of their reunion. They then go to sea on a honeymoon, averaging 10 days, while the female acquires bodily resources for building an egg. No one knows whether they feed each other chocolates out there during this time or even stay together at all, but they often return to the island within a few hours of each other. Upon arrival back at the colony, the female usually lays her egg within a day. None of this orderly progression is apparent here on the island. Your main impression is bewildering busyness, birds constantly coming and going. After the female lays, she leaves in a hurry, usually the same day. Her need to immediately get back out to sea for food reflects how expensive egg laying is, probably because of the inequitable cost to her body condition of constructing that large egg. The male takes a larger overall share of incubation, sitting about a week longer than the female when you sum all their time. When the male takes the first incubation shift, he sits 3 solid weeks on the egg until she returns. Then she takes possession of the egg and he goes to sea for 2 or 3 weeks. After that, the spells grow shorter, something like a couple of weeks back on the egg for the male, then a week or so for mom, maybe followed by a few more days for dad. With all that alternating activity and inactivity, their bodily condition fluctuates dramatically. Albatrosses first arrive plump and sassy with thick layers of fat under their skin and around their organs. Laysan males show up weighing nearly 7.5 pounds and females close to 7. For the first 10 days or so, the male doesn't eat enough to maintain his weight and loses mass until he weighs about the same as the female. He regains much of this during the honeymoon at sea. When the honeymoon is over, the female instantly loses 10 to 12% of her body weight laying that big egg. She gains it back at sea during the male's first incubation shift. Meanwhile, he's incubating without food or water, getting lighter again. During the long bouts of incubation, they fluctuate inversely, each in turn losing roughly 20% of their weight on the nest, while their mate out at sea is regaining much of its condition. During normal incubation, after about 5 or 6 parental shifts and an elapsed time of over 2 months, the male has sat for about 36 days and the female for 29. These are averages for Laysan albatrosses. They vary. One whose mate was killed just after she laid her egg sat for 32 days instead of the usual single day. After about 65 days of incubation, the chick stages its grueling, slow-motion breakout. In the 24 hours, or sometimes several days, during which the chick struggles to emerge, the adults will render only abundant moral support and no physical or material assistance, a model of perfect parenting. Albatrosses are good at staying alive. About 65% of eggs, on average, result in chicks that survive to fledging age. About 10% die at the perilous transition to first flight. Of those that survive fledging, annual survival is often an extraordinary 93 to 98% through at least age 20. Many albatrosses live much longer. Scientists aren't sure exactly how long yet because a lot of albatrosses still living have been wearing leg bands for 40 years, outlasting some of the original researchers who wished to know. And I'll insert here that Wisdom has laid an egg this year at Midway Atoll, and she's 75 and probably older than that, banded in 1956. Back to the book. Most albatrosses here are incubating solitarily, but some have company, sitting or standing inches away. Some sit touching bill to bill. The companions might be mates just returned from sea, waiting their turn at incubating, or they might be visitors. Albatross social relationships are complicated and poorly understood. "Look," says Dave, "this bird is sitting on an egg and somebody else just walked up to it and started preening it around the head, and it accepted the preening. What does that mean? The bird is almost certainly not its mate, but they may have long-term relationships that are very cryptic to us." As we watch the interaction, Dave continues, "The birds may know each other. One might be the offspring of the other, hatched here years ago. Or they could be acquaintances, and they might become mates at some time in the future if something bad happens to the mate of the bird that's on the egg. That kind of stuff is very obscure to us. The only way you can get at it is long-term, by watching season after season, trying to see how these relationships are developing. But that's really hard to do. With long-lived seabirds, I think a lot of it is about relationships," unquote. Dave adds that a student of his just finished a long study of divorce and masked boobies. Quote, he learned that if you're a booby and you and your mate split up, you're much less likely to breed the next year, unquote. Dave says biologists tend to collect data on the number of eggs, number of chicks hatching, number surviving in the nest, that sort of thing, but not very much on relationships. Virtually everything about human society is about relationships, Dave says, and I think we're missing a lot by not putting more effort into trying to understand relationships in societies of other animals, unquote. Though most albatrosses have spent the last months incubating, many are still courting. These are probably non-breeders, but it's not always clear what their status is. As you walk along, you see them engaged in different kinds of courtship, from quiet mutual preening to raucous, reckless dancing. Watching them is delightful and intellectually challenging. Dave, observing that some of the birds here are non-breeding adults, wonders aloud how adults decide whether to breed in a given year. Anthony, explaining the main emerging finding of his developing research, says that these albatrosses can't raise a chick and regrow all their feathers in the same year because each task requires almost as much energy as an albatross can earn by foraging. Trying to do both would result in energy bankruptcy, starvation. So after one or more years of breeding, they may have to take a year off to molt their feathers. There's an important implication. One of the most important things that will decide what will happen to these albatrosses is how many chicks a bird can produce during its life. Most people have assumed they breed every year from when they first mature to when they die. Anthony says, but skipping breeding in years when they're molting will really affect total lifetime reproduction. Understanding this is important for calculating whether or not albatross populations will grow or decline in response to things like the number of birds being killed by fishing boats, unquote. Anthony gestures to the birds around us and continues, albatrosses themselves have to know when their mate needs to skip a year and when their mate is ready to breed. Otherwise, the pairs will get out of phase with each other, unquote. How can they communicate such information to each other? Dave and Anthony both agree that there are many things we don't understand about the lives of animals that live a long time. Letting the others walk ahead, I sit, albatross eye level, at the edge of the coral powder runway and watch something so strange, it seems familiarly human. This pair has been sitting next to each other for many long minutes, nibbling tenderly around each other's faces, taking turns preening each other with extraordinary gentleness, each bird soaking it up as though this is the greatest luxury. Right now, one bird is working the small feathers right around the other's eye. The recipient turns its head sideways so the first bird can reach its cheek, its throat. Watching them preening so delicately, enjoying it with eyes closed, you sense this is as immensely pleasurable for them as it would be for us, something anyone who has ever been tenderly touched would recognize. Not all the courting implies partnership intentions. Some birds are preening in threesomes, and several little clubs of up to half a dozen adolescents or non-nesting birds are displaying or interacting together. Many of the courting birds are immature. Juveniles remain at sea for several years and then visit the breeding island for several additional years of courtship before acquiring a mate and themselves breeding. Laysans first breed at 8 to 9 years of age, usually. So these displaying birds may be adolescents just practicing or maturing birds getting serious about the future. If the latter, they are forming a true bond that will bring them back next year to mate and invest in the months-long struggle of raising their first chick. I resume walking. Every few steps brings a new sight that expands my appreciation of albatrosses' unusually complex behaviors. Two non-breeders are playing house with a cold, abandoned egg. One attempts awkwardly to sit on it, perhaps getting a feel for being grown up. I've done a lot of research with seabirds, but I've never heard of anything quite like this apparent role-playing with a found egg. By far the most complicated part of albatross courtship is the elaborate and prolonged dancing that goes on for months. Quite a few birds that aren't breeding are dancing. One albatross waddlingly approaches another with its neck outstretched and its head pointed down, its throat quivering out a high wavering whistle. The other responds in kind. They engage in a bout of beak-to-beak touching, shaking their heads back and forth, as if saying no but meaning yes. They begin to dance, their movements together intensifying in speed and emphasis. Albatross, shake, rattle, and roll dances look like a game of Simon Says, but with everything done so fast, it's often impossible to tell who's leading. Simon Says head up. Simon Says head down. Simon Says vigorously pump your head. Simon Says bray like a donkey. Simon Says throw your bill straight upward to the sky and scream your wavering whistle. Simon Says wing out sideways, flare wings, and moo. Oh, how beautiful. Nice new feathers. And they're not just going through the steps. During these dances, they seem truly carried away, like holy rollers, whirling dervishes. These birds are globe-trotting athletes, and they dance with Olympian energy. Everything in the dancing is about displaying quality, paying close attention to each other's motions, instantly matching their partner's movements. Speed, coordination, synchrony. They may be saying, in effect, I'm healthy and vigorous. Look at how fast I can do this. Or look at me, the sleek, strong feathers I have for flying. Make me a reliable food getter. It's all about showing and assessing health, vigor, and prime condition. Can you keep up with me? Are you fast? Can you cut it with me? Can I cut it with you? Are you worthy of my offspring and the best years of my long life? Lazen and black-footed albatrosses are more varied and faster dancers than all other albatrosses. Dances may last 15 minutes. They are highly dynamic performances, unlike the stereotyped courtship in many birds. No two albatross dances are the same. Most dances end with slowing pace, followed by bowing, and then the female wandering off. After the dance, they may sit quietly together for a while, and then dance with another bird. Most dances are between a male and a female. Some, less than 10%, involve threesomes or small groups, and two females will dance together occasionally, two males rarely. Prospecting females may spend a third of their time ashore dancing. Wandering and royal albatross dances involve full extension and display of both enormous wings, something not done by smaller albatrosses with lesser spans to boast. Sooty and light-mantled sooty albatrosses, which have been called the Siamese cats of the bird world for their lovely shading, do much of their courtship aloft during beautifully synchronized flights. They are gracile and exquisitely elegant birds, even among albatrosses, superb forms of life. And I will stop reading there. We're still in the first chapter of this wonderful book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival by Carl Safina. We're in the remote parts of the Hawaiian Islands, as remote as we can be from the continents. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.